And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's continuing efforts, not broadcast live from CFEV Radio in the basement of the Student Union building at the University of Victoria, but emanating live to tape via Skype from our home base studios on this date, September 4th, 2020. While we all grew up with the infomercial length Canadian History Bites Heritage Minutes, with production values just hokey enough to appear made by the Ministry of Education for your grade 6 socials class, the upbeat and nationhood-affirming vignettes have become, like the Trans Canada and some other stuff, one of the things that makes us Canadians Canadian. And like some of the best love stories we like to tell ourselves about ourselves, Heritage Minutes is just a pile of crap. Or so contends my first guest, in not so many words. Tyler Shipley is professor of culture, society, and commerce at Humber College's Institute of Technology and Advanced Learning and founding member of the Canadian polyprog band Consumer Goods. His first book, Ottawa and Empire, Canada and the Military Coup in Honduras, taught us more about ourselves than we hoped to learn, and the same is promised of his second title, Canada in the World, Settler Capitalism and the Colonial Imagination. His recent article, The Stunning Misinformation and Whitewashing of Racism Behind Canada's Heritage Minutes, currently challenges our childhood indoctrination from the pages of the Canada Files website. Tyler Shipley in the first half. And way back near the turn of the century, when the unbridled power of transnational capital and its enabling mechanism, the modern corporation, threatened to destroy democracy, Vancouver-based legal scholar and filmmaker Joel Bakken released the now classic documentary film, The Corporation. More than 15 years later, Bakken has revisited the topic with his newly released book, The New Corporation, How Good Corporations Are Bad for Democracy, and he's teamed up again with fellow corporation director Jennifer Abbott on the new film, The New Corporation, The Unfortunately Necessary Sequel. Joel Bakken and revisiting The Corporation 15 years later in the second half. And CFEV radio broadcaster and host of Plant Powered Radio, Janine Bancroft, will be here at the bottom of the hour with the Left Coast Events Bullet, bringing us up to speed with some of what's good going on in and around our town in the coming week. But first, Tyler Shipley and catching up on Canada's pretend history, even as the real one catches up with us. Well, welcome back to the show, Tyler.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Tyler, how dare you, sir? Just when we Canucks were starting to feel good about our past, now this. It's enough to make John A. McDonald's head roll right off of his shoulders. But seriously, Tyler, who's responsible for the massive multi-generational disinformation campaign known as the Heritage Minutes?
Well, the minutes themselves were sort of the brainchild of a billionaire who was at the time the 14th richest Canadian. This was in the early 90s, a man named Charles Bronfman, who was a sort of a, you know, one of these colorful capitalist figures in Canada at the time. He had owned the Montreal Alouettes football team, an earlier version that collapsed. He had owned the Montreal Expos baseball team, which was sold. So he was sort of a prominent capitalist figure. But I mean, his money, of course, was part of a long-standing capitalist empire based in Montreal. They had a huge sort of corporate empire. Seagram was one of their big brands, the alcohol brand Seagram. They owned an oil company, which later became known as Sunoco. So this is a very, very rich man. And it's the mid-90s, and it's a cultural moment in Canada of confusion. Canada doesn't and when I say Canada, I sort of mean, you know, popular culture in Canada doesn't really know what to make of itself. It had cultivated an image as a peacekeeper during the Cold War, as a kind of more reasonable character in the Cold War. And a lot of Canadians believed that, though it wasn't true. But then the 90s, with the end of the Cold War and the ongoing sort of calamities in the world, you know, the horrific genocide and problems in Somalia and in Rwanda, things that Canada couldn't seem to solve, problems that Canada's, you know, good nature couldn't seem to deal with, there was this reckoning about what Canada represented. And the rich in Canada were very concerned that the Canadians weren't proud enough of their history, that Canadian, and of course they mean Johnny MacDonald, you know, the RCMP, the military, the traditional figures of authority. There was a kind of an opening in the 90s to the potential that maybe Indigenous people were part of history and they should be taught in school. You know, maybe we should teach the history of women in Canada. You know, there was a whole kind of opening up to the possibility that history was more than just, you know, old white men who signed documents. And the rich didn't like that. They wanted it to be back the way it used to be. So Bronfman, this millionaire, billionaire, I should say, was the architect of the Heritage Minutes. And as I say, he explicitly created them with a purpose of instilling Canadian pride. So that's the kind of the genesis. That's where they came from.
Well, and it's been super effective because even in my introduction, I say multi-generational and that every kid grew up. But in reading your article, I see that it only started in the 90s, but I could have sworn that I remember seeing these like forever, even as back as far as when I was a kid. But that's not, I'm fooling myself.
Yeah, they have that really timeless, as you say, a sort of a kitschy Canadiana feel to them. You know, and I think it's, I mean, they were very effective. They are very effective because they do invoke that kind of timeless, you know, gosh, you know, sitting around watching the CBC and the Heritage Minutes, you know, and there is this sense that they sort of transcend the Canadian experience. But yeah, I mean, you know, they started in the early 90s and a bunch were made in the 90s. A new set were made in the early 2000s. They are still making them. They've produced a bunch of new ones in the last 5 or 6 years. And, you know, one of the things that struck me, I went to the sort of the Historica Foundation's website and looked up all of their kind of foundational documents. And they specifically said that the vignettes, the Heritage Minutes would, quote, reflect and celebrate Canadian social and cultural values, which they define as tolerance, fairness, courage, tenacity, resourcefulness, inventiveness, all of which sounds great. You know, I like all those things. The lie, of course, was in claiming that those things were the core values of Canada, that Canada's actions in the world, historically and in the present, reflected those values. And of course, you know, the book that I have just published is sustained critique of the idea that Canada represents those values.
Yeah, I more see Canada as a nation of half-assed hewers of wood and carriers of water, personally. But hey, that sounds great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that is better than brainwashing. And well, you know, and it happens so you know, I think passively to so many of us. I grew up watching the Heritage Minutes. I largely accepted the narrative that they provided of Canada. It wasn't until I was much older that I you know even began to rethink some of the things that I'd been taught by the Heritage Minutes. And you know, so if a person doesn't for whatever reason find themselves on a path to questioning that stuff, what was there in the Heritage Minutes, it'll stick. It'll stay.
Well, yeah, and as I said, I thought I grew up. I've been indoctrinated so well by them that it just seems to me that they're timeless and that they've been there forever, when in fact they haven't. In your article, now again, it's the stunning misinformation and whitewashing of racism behind Canada's Heritage Minutes, and you can find that at thecanadafiles.com, a new site, newish, I guess, anyway. You've got, there are on this site examples of some of these Heritage Minutes, the stills here with Canada Post being a proud sponsor, the CRB Foundation and Actor as well. But, you know, in this article, you've got a picture of Peter Bronfman. I'm not sure if you put that on in there or that was included by the editors at Canada Files, but he looks astonishingly similar to the Simpsons' Monty Burns in this picture. Did you take this picture up?
I don't know if I picked that one, but I know the one you mean, and it's really remarkable, isn't it? What I find most interesting about the pictures, at least a few of the ones that I saw associated with the article, is how close you can see the closeness or the ways in which the Bronfman family is interwoven in you know, the sort of the elite class. You know, the ruling class in Canada and the United States. There's a picture with David Rockefeller There's a picture with Pierre Trudeau. You know, you get a sense when you look at the sort of the Bronfman legacy that these are people who are deeply interwoven into power in Canada, especially, but you know, in the world more generally. And again, I think that's a reminder. It's a useful reminder of, you know, when we watch the Heritage Minutes, we're not getting some sort of unfiltered, you know, just a little snapshot, you know, like a box in a textbook of some piece of Canadian history. We are getting the ideology of the super rich. I mean, we are getting the ideology of those who most want to maintain the world in its exact present form. And I think that's really important, you know, and to view the Heritage Minutes with that in mind really changes the way that you watch them.
Well, and the way that they're produced to look like they're emanating from the government, and even the way that the Canadian media establishment itself is co-opted into it with Patrick Watson. I mean, younger listeners might not remember, but he was an iconic media figure from the CBC, best known maybe for his later long-form documentary Democracy. And his soothing voice just leads you right in and saying, oh, well, of course, you know, this is a legit, this is, doesn't have an agenda. This is just the facts.
Yeah, they have that feel, don't they? They really just seem like, you know, like I think you maybe said this at the top of the show, they seem like something from social studies class. Yeah. You know, they seem like something that would be just part of, you know, an educational program. And of course, that's true, actually. They are like that. The lie that we tell ourselves is that social studies classes are somehow ideologically neutral. They're not. I mean, the Canadian curriculum is actually in many ways reflective of the Heritage Minutes and vice versa. They are both part of the kind of ideological apparatus of Canadian popular culture and consciousness. But I mean, because we have that inherent trust in what seems like an educational program, again, we're disarmed. We go into those Heritage Minutes and we think, well, you know, this must be true. And of course, the minutes, they don't usually lie. I mean, there's not a lot of, you won't find a lot of outright lies in the Heritage Minutes. What you get is obfuscation, misdirection, you know, emphasis on the wrong things. Stuff that is left out that is crucially important. I mean, framing. It's so much of I guess the twisted genius of them is the framing. You know, I'll give you an example. One of the best Heritage Minutes, you know, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most valuable ones is one called Nitro. It's from the original set, I think, 1991 or two, and it's about the construction of the railroad. The Transcontinental Railroad, and in particular the Chinese workers who were brought in, that they were hyper exploited in this process. It was extremely dangerous work. They were paid very little to do it. They were given no credit. They were obviously subject to racism during the construction, but also afterwards. You know, famously when they tried to you know, remain in Canada and bring their families over to join them, Canada tried to block this by imposing an increasingly expensive tax on those family members. So the minute is good. The Heritage Minute about this is pretty good. I would say of all of the ones that I watched them all, it is probably one of the best. But here's the trick. At the very end, what you discover is that the narrator of this Heritage Minute, the person who's telling the story of this racism that they experienced, is a grandfather who is one of the workers on the railroad. He's in a middle-class, comfortable home. His grandchildren are all around him, and he's telling this story of what he experienced. And what this says to the person watching is, wow, Canada did a pretty bad thing there. Thank God we solved it. Thank God we fixed the problem. Look, he had a rough life on the railroad, but there he is now, comfortable and happy and wealthy and surrounded by his family. You know, we made some mistakes, but we sure have fixed them, haven't we? You know, the viewer can walk away from this feeling good about Canada, maybe even thinking it's a good thing that this guy came to Canada because now he's got a better life. I mean, that's the trick of the Heritage Minutes. They didn't lie. they just framed this in a way that leaves you thinking Canada's somehow the good guy, even when Canada was the bad guy.
Well, the best lies contain some truth. You describe it as a masterclass in obfuscation. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Tyler Shipley. Tyler is professor of culture, society, and commerce at Humber College's Institute of Technology and Advanced Learning. He's a founding member, and hey, Tyler, I made this word up myself, of the Canadian Polyprog Band. How do you like that?
Yeah, I heard that at the top. Yeah, I love it.
I hope I made that up. I don't think I've ever heard it. It's the band called Consumer Goods. You do solo stuff now. Consumer Goods is sadly not with us anymore. A terrific band. His first book, Ottawa and Empire, Canada and the Military Coup in Honduras. And the second, his newest book is Canada in the World, Settler Capitalism and the Colonial Imagination. Well, you know, talking about this, the situation we're in now with education, with the COVID and everything else, the idea of distance learning seems, this really brings another point of view on these Canada Minutes, where, you know, pre-canned educational material being sent, whether it's over the TV or the computer, looks like it's going to become a bigger and bigger part if things continue in their present trajectory of the education system here.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, certainly in the colleges, we're really aware of this. And, you know, I think, in you know, the consequence that concerns me most is that, you know, the question is, who's creating that content then? And how is it being framed? And is it going to look like those Heritage Minutes? And, you know, and how much capacity will teachers and professors and instructors have to at the very least, sometimes you can teach against bad material. You know, I've had to teach courses where I didn't design the course, and maybe, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there that doesn't jive with what I want to teach, but at least I can teach around it, and I can teach students to be critical, and I can, you know, encourage them to, you know, watch a Heritage Minute, for instance, and then discuss what is good and bad about it. I can do that in the classroom, but, you know, when we go into this kind of online teaching environment, you know, I think there's a real tendency for it to become a bit one directional. Just, you know, here's the content, go learn it. And I mean, that's concerning. And I think it's concerning in a context here where there's a lot of people in this country that are really, really having a hard time coming to grips with their history. Yeah. You know, and you know, we saw that after the John A. McDonald, the unfortunate tumble that John A. took and hit his head there.
I want to get to that too. You know, I'll just tell you before that though, you mentioned about, you know, well, maybe Indigenous people are a part of history in this country and should be taught as such. When I took my first year pre-Confederation Canadian history class at college level, the first day, the first time the professor addressed the class, he said, look, now, I get this question every year, and I'm going to tell you all right now, so don't ask me. We're not going to talk about Indians in this class because this is a class on Canadian history, so don't even go there.
Wow.
And that's a college-level class.
Yeah.
But right, now this was a long time ago, before the minutes, but that definitely was the attitude.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it's funny too. It contain that statement contains actually a really important truth in it, which is that Canada never considered Indigenous people to be part of Canada, right? I mean, today in 2020, you know, the ideological push is to say, oh no, we're all Canadian, and Indigenous people are part of it, and we're in this mosaic, and we all get along now, and racism is in the past. The truth is that when Canada was built, you know, the early Canadians understood full well that they were conquering Indigenous nations. They understood them to be foreign nations with foreign relations. In fact, that's the central argument of the book that I'm publishing, is precisely that the relations between the French, English, and then Canadian settlers and the Indigenous nations that they encountered, that is the first and the foundational foreign policy of Canada. And if you understand Canada's relations with those Indigenous nations as foreign policy, all the rest of Canada's foreign policy, you know, from the Boer War in South Africa to, you know, the intervention in the Congo in the 60s to the Vietnam War to Afghanistan, it all makes so much more sense. if you see it as sort of derived from that foundation, which was colonialism. So, I mean, your college professor, for the wrong reason, I think, stumbled upon something that actually does have some truth, which is that Canada doesn't include Indigenous people. As much as Justin Trudeau might you know, want to tell us that it does, you know, I think a lot of Indigenous people know that this country was not built for them. It was built on them, you know, and built to conquer them. And I think that's something, again, that the Heritage Minutes tried to obscure.
Well, I'm pretty confident that he's long dead now, and that his head, like McDonald's, would roll off the shoulders in his grave if he could see what's going on right now. We'll talk a little bit more about Canada in the world, but for this segment, we're going to have to discontinue it here, Tyler, but I want everybody else to know that you can go to guerrilla-radio.com to get the full interview, and for those listening on CFUV, stay tuned. Janine's coming straight up with this week's Left Coast Events Bulletin, and to be followed by Joel back and talking about the corporation, the resurgence of the corporation, the new corporation, the unfortunately necessary sequel. Again, Tyler Shipley's article is The Stunning Misinformation and Whitewashing of Racism Behind Canada's Heritage Minutes. You can find that at the Canada Files online. And your book, Canada in the World, Settler Capitalism and the Colonial Imagination, Canada in the World, you can do a search to find Tyler's book. I really appreciate you coming on, and for such a long time, too, and on such one of our precious last days of the summer here, Tyler.
No, it's my pleasure, Chris. Thanks for asking, and thanks for asking great questions and a great conversation.
Well, and good luck with the book, eh? And we'll play some of your music in the background there. We lament at the end of consumer goods, but Tyler Shipley's independent efforts, musical efforts, can be found at his Bandcamp site, tylershipley.bandcamp.com. Thanks again, Tyler.
Thank you, Chris. Take care.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999. Right here, 11 a.m. Thursdays at CFUV.ca.
We're running out of time to put out a fire. Fire.
Today, September 10th, and going all the way till the 15th, is a virtual summit for forestry reform in British Columbia. It's an online summit to discuss the future of forest management and old growth protection. There will be speakers and panelists discussing the importance of creating a future that supports and respects Indigenous systems and gives power back to communities on the front lines of logging. Check that out at forestmarch.bc to learn more. Also this weekend, starting on the 11th and going till the 13th, the annual Canadian Animal Law Conference, focused on animal law with an emphasis on Canada and North America, but informed by global approaches. So lots of thought-provoking presentations from leading experts around the world, including lawyers, scholars, scientists, and advocates. Anyone can attend. You don't have to be a legal person. You can be just a regular person who's interested. And you go to CanadianAnimalLawConference.ca for information on that. September 12th and 13th is a stream keepers training happening at Roberts Creek. And this is actually happening live and in person, so up in the Seashelt area somewhere. Check the Facebook if you're interested on the details of that and the whereabouts. It's all about learning how to be a good steward for salmon streams. On the weekend, Saturday, September 12th, a workshop, Herbs for Winter Wellness, a chance to fill our pantries with herbs for immune support, for lung and sinus support, how to incorporate herbs, plants, and foods to support our general wellness and awareness of wellness, and making herbal syrups and cider, and it's offered through the Compost Education Center. can check that out. On Saturday, September 12th, Threshold Housing's 30th anniversary virtual gala. They support at-risk youth across the Capital Regional District and are honoring the investment made by countless stakeholders over the last 3 decades. They're holding this gala online to highlight their effort and celebrate the impact that Threshold has had in the community. So you can go to their website, Threshold Housing, or check the Facebook event, and there are tickets available. Road to the Supreme Court of Canada, Our Climate Future on the Line, is an event happening on Monday, September 14th from noon till 1. An exclusive conversation with eco-justice lawyers who will be going to the Supreme Court of Canada. This is an opportunity to get a behind-the-scenes look at what it takes to prepare for a legal showdown that will decide the fate of the Greenhouse Gas Pollution Pricing Act. So it's an online session. Go to the Facebook for information on that, or eco-justice, the online. On Tuesday, September 15th, Sexual and Gender Diversity Competency Training. This is for nonprofits and people who work in communities dealing with issues like homelessness, suicide, hate crimes, and economic inequality. And an opportunity to learn how to be more aware of sexual and gender diversity as we're working with different populations in our various work areas. So again, I would say check the Facebook. The description is Sexual and Gender Diversity Competency Training on Tuesday, September 15th. Court support for Indigenous land defenders on the 15th till the 18th at the BC Supreme Court in Vancouver, showing solidarity with land defenders who were found in contempt of court for peacefully protesting the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion on Brandy Mountain. Wednesday, free Orange Shirt Day online classroom. So I learned about this when I was working in the schools last year. The Orange Shirt Day is honored in the schools, and so this is an opportunity to learn more about this. It's a story of a residential school survivor. And if you want to go online, you can go to medicinewheel.education and find that September 16th, starting at 10 till 11:30. There is a watermelon pizza party for the animals at Home for Hooves up near Duncan. You can throw in $10 and donate watermelon for all the various animals that live there, and then watch online as they enjoy that Wednesday the 16th. There's also a lecture, Akbar Broke My Heart, as part of this distinguished lecture series taking place September 16th, and is organized through the university, I believe. This is Brazilian Zulu literature in a relational frame. So Zuo literary texts, which is the connection between the domination, incarceration, torture, and killability of so-called animals, so-called criminals, and so-called non-whites. What is the connection? So sounds an interesting conversation. Check it out on Facebook. And that's what I found for this week. Thanks, Chris.
Come through, you can mix up my metaphors. before, shake out the dust in my eyes. Cause I've been dead in my heart since 2000 something. Keep doing the same thing, surprise, nothing's changing. Let Chevron and Shell write the rules and the water will rise. I can see a future I don't want to live in, where I'm angry and sad and I'm lonely and I won't give in. I don't see the point of living if that's where I go. See, the fascists are coming, our days might be numbered. There's things I've forgotten, I gotta remember. Like putting out love without knowing where it's gonna go. In 36 years, I've gotten accustomed to seeing the signs, to knowing the hustle, getting out early when the damage can still be contained. Treat life like a Facebook so carefully curated. Gas that Corolla while pumping on the brake. No ruffling feathers are in appropriate pain. Cause I can see a future I don't want to live in, where I'm angry and sad and I'm lonely and I won't give in. And I don't see the point living if that's where I go. See, the fascists are coming, our days might be numbered. There's things I've forgotten, I gotta remember. Like putting out love without knowing where it's gonna go. Back to the point, yeah, the matter at hand is that I've met someone who could break me in half with a look, a whisper, a snap, or an unreturned text. I should bail, there's no question this is gonna end badly. Since every instinct I've developed to keep me, but fuck it, I'm staying, please pull me ashore when I'm ready. See a future I don't want to live in, where I'm angry and sad and I'm lonely and I won't give in. And I don't see the point of living if that's where I go. See, the fascists are coming, our days might be numbered. There's things I've forgotten, I've gotta remember. Like putting out love without knowing where it's gonna go.
And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's continuing efforts, not broadcast from CFUV Radio in the basement of the Student Union Building at the University of Victoria, but emanating live to tape via Skype from our home base studios on this date, September 3rd, 2020. Well, way back near the turn of the century, when the unbridled power of transnational capital and its enabling mechanism, the modern corporation, threatened to destroy democracy, Vancouver-based legal scholar and filmmaker Joel Bakken released The Corporation, The Pathological Pursuit of Profit and Power. His book was accompanied by the now classic documentary film The Corporation, a collaboration of the author and filmmakers Mark Akbar and Jennifer Abbott. Now, more than 15 years later, Bakken has revisited the topic with his newly released book, The New Corporation, How Good Corporations Are Bad for Democracy, and teamed up again with fellow director Jennifer Abbott on a tandem film, The New Corporation, The Unfortunately Necessary Sequel. Welcome back to the program, Joel.
Thanks. It's great to be on, Chris.
Well, it's my pleasure, of course. Now, when last we spoke in February of 2004, a maniacal American president in the service of big business was running roughshod across the planet, leaving a trail of busted hopes and misery and mayhem and destruction wherever his boot came to ground. Now, Joel, for our listeners experiencing a disorienting sense of deja vu, what's changed since then?
Well, the way you put it, I would have to say nothing. But many things have changed since then. And I guess one indication of that is that the current maniacal president in the United States is arguably even more maniacal and more destructive. And I think it's an indication of everywhere we look, whatever we look at, how much things have changed. If we look at climate, when we made the first film, climate was a crisis. Now it's an existential crisis. If we look at inequality, economic inequality, racial inequality, the same thing. It's gone from being bad to really sort of humanity threatening in its scope and depth. We look at democracy. Democracy was hardly perfect in the early 2000s, but now it's arguably on the ropes. People at least talked as though it was important at that time. And there was a sense that, you know, we just had to kind of take the ideals that everybody agreed on and make them work better. Now it's like people don't necessarily all agree that democracy is a good thing, or their sense of what it is just so completely thin and distorted that it doesn't even resemble anything that we used to think of as democracy. And I think, you know, Trump is a great example of that. The fact that we're being run by big tech behemoths, mega corporations that didn't even exist in any kind of size or scope when we made the first film. And what's really interesting is, you know, while the world is kind of teetering on the brink of an abyss in a way that it wasn't in the early 2000s, corporations since about 2005 have been presenting themselves as the good guys. I mean, I can't tell you how many business people came to me after the first film and book and said, yeah, you know, you have a point. I mean, we were kind of screwing up. We were being psychopathic, but we're better now. We are now sustainable. We are now socially responsible. We care about society. We're going to solve COVID. You know, we're in favor of Black Lives Matter. I mean, corporations since around 2005, since around just after the first film, have really made a concerted effort to tell us that they are the good guys, that they are the solution providers, not the cause of the problems. And the central thesis in this book and film is that, A, they're no different really than they were before. They're just talking a much better game. But B, they're managing to leverage that talk into greater power. They're saying, hey, we're good now, so we can run the world. We can run your water systems. We can run your schools. And so there's a way in which there's a real symbiotic connection between this movement that corporations are saying we're good and their increasing power over the world and their increasing freedom from any kind of accountability and control.
Well, it's almost as if they woke up all of a sudden, right, and saw that they had a responsibility. What about us, though, Joel? When your first film was released, the zeitgeist at the time, there was big demonstrations against the G20, G8, the IMF, the World Economic Forum. These routinely drew massive protests right up through the Toronto protest in 2010. How about the people now and the people that are receiving your sequel, especially the younger generation that really don't have a grounding in what the fight against corporations was all about?
Well, I think in some ways, and my sense is that when you look at young people, in a way, I think it's a blessing that they don't have a grounding, because part of our grounding was, well, we just have to accept all of this. You know, there's not much we can do about it. Yeah, we can hit the streets and have mass protests as we did. But beyond that, there's not much we can do. When I look at what young people are doing today, it's a lot more exciting than what we were doing before. And in both the book and film, we try to sort of tell a contemporary history moving from those early protests, which I think are partly what woke up corporations to the fact that their legitimacy was slipping and that they had to, you know, up their game in terms of presenting themselves as good. But there's this really interesting thing that happened after the 2008 financial crisis. We have the Occupy movement. And the Occupy movement was really different than what we experienced in the early 2000s with the anti-globalization movement. The Occupy movement, basically protesters, you know, didn't have that grounding about marching. And young people said, you know, instead of marching, we should just sit down. We should just take over the public square. We should take over the streets. We should try to reenact what democracy would look like in an urban space and sit down rather than march through. And that was kind of the character of it. It wasn't a march. It was a sit down, a sit in on a massive, massive scale in taking over squares in cities like Barcelona and New York and Vancouver, setting up camps, setting up tents, setting up food services, medical clinics, setting up systems as sort of maybe looking back, perhaps naive as they were, but attempts to enact what might be called participatory democracy. And this was astounding in terms of a kind of shift from this idea that all we could do was protest. Now we were protesting, but we were also propositioning. We were also saying, it's not just about saying, don't do this, stop doing that. It's about saying, this is how we need to do things. This is how we create a community in a public space. And so taking that history even a bit further in the film and the book, we look at people, including, for example, Michael White, who was one of the co-founders of the Occupy movement, or Shama Sawant, who was a major Occupy activist. And we look at what they're saying now. And what they're saying basically is, okay, in the early 2000s, we marched. In the 2010s, we sat. And now in the 2020s, what we need to do is not just take over the streets, we need to take over government. So we need, as activists, to get back to something that we had left behind quite a while ago. And that is large P politics. That is trying to get elected. That is trying to get elected, have sovereign power, and do something progressive with it. And so there's this whole new model creating that's being created of what democratic governance can look like. I think Bernie Sanders is an obvious example of that. But what we do in the film is we try to look at how that's happening at more local levels. And the sort of key idea, whether you're talking to the mayor of Barcelona or you're talking to Shama Sawant in Seattle on the city council, or you're talking to Bernie Sanders, the key idea is to understand electoral politics as being intrinsically both connected to and always in a kind of tension with social movement politics, but a creative tension, and to keep those connections together. So if you look at the last 20 years, there's actually a really interesting story of marching through the streets, taking over the squares and trying to enact participatory democracies, and then actually trying to take over democratic governance and make democracy work the way it's supposed to.
Well, if you back 20 years ago, 1999 in Seattle, and the infamous APEC meetings in Vancouver, and the litany of other ones, they used the burgeoning technology, the communication technologies, to organize in a way that with speed and alacrity that had never been seen before. In preceding the Occupy movement in 2011 in North Africa, we saw the Arab Spring blow up using these same technologies, and their Occupy movements, their square, the movement of the squares that started there and spread throughout Europe and jumped the Atlantic back to North America, was really inspired by their example. Today, in your film, the corporations that we should really be worried about, I'll put it banally, they were hardly players, if they even existed at all way back then. Do you want to talk a little bit about the role of the technology corporation in today's movement, and how that is something wholly new to the situation that you faced or that you chronicled rather in your first film?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are obviously two dimensions to this. And one is the fact that the tools that have been provided from these tech behemoths like Facebook and Google and others definitely have been used by activist movements. And we see that happening, as you mentioned, and we show in the film the movement of the squares and how that leads to Occupy. I think it's also important to note, and I go into more detail in the book on this point, that that's just a tool. I mean, it's just like, you know, taking the subway to a protest march. There was a real kind of large magnification of the idea that these were the Facebook and Twitter revolutions. They weren't. Politics is not about a technology that enables people to get in touch with each other. The movement of the squares were a lot more than that. We can talk more about that in a moment. But did you want me then to talk a little bit about the other side of these tech behemoths? And that is a challenge they present to democracy.
Well, democracy is really the issue here, isn't it?
Democracy is the issue. And I mean, the sort of background concern of this project, of the film and of the book, is that we're actually at a point where not only are we facing this planetary crisis in terms of climate change and the environment, but we're facing a crisis in terms of democratic citizenship and democracy itself. I think we're at a point, as I mentioned, where in the early 2000s, there was a view that we believed in democracy, we just had to make it work better. And people had different views about what that meant. I think we're at a point now, you know, when I was talking to people from the tech industry in making this film and book, where people actually say, no, democracy is outdated. We don't need democracy anymore. And there are many, many different ways that that manifests itself. There's a view like Peter Thiel talks about that our society would be better if it's run by benevolent, in his words, corporations like Google and Facebook. There's a view that we can delegate the job of governing to blockchain and other kind of technologies. But the idea that, you know, we should have a very live and vibrant democracy is one that doesn't have a lot of cachet in Silicon Valley. Even those people who call themselves liberals rather than libertarians, who see themselves as progressive in Silicon Valley, are very much committed to pushing back trade unions, to pushing back regulations, to privatizing things like education, healthcare, and so on. So even among the so-called progressives who are in the tech sector, nowhere is there a sense that democracy should be a broad, social, and robust enterprise. The idea is that technology can solve all these problems. We don't need government anymore. And obviously, that's a very profitable idea. We're seeing it run during coronavirus. You know, we don't need classrooms. We don't need schools. We don't need universities. We can do everything on Zoom. We can do everything digitally. We don't need office spaces anymore. You know, we don't really need people anymore at some level. So there's some really problematic sides to the ideology that's being pushed by the big tech sector, and also to the actual influence that they have over policy in pushing for deregulation and pushing for privatization and pushing for lower taxes and pushing for fewer distributive kinds of policies. And so basically what I argue in the book more explicitly, but it's in the film as well, is that the tech industry is really not like any other industry in relation to regulation. You know, just like the auto industry and the airplane industry and smokestack industries needed to be regulated to prevent society from being harmed by the negative effects of what they were doing, it's exactly the same with tech. And there's a view that somehow tech is different, but it's not at all. The bottom line is that in a democracy, it's the people through their elected representatives, through their democratic institutions, that need to be in control of things, including in control of industries that increasingly are playing such a huge role in every aspect of our lives.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Joel Back, and Joel is the author of The Corporation, The Pathological Pursuit of Profit and Power, and the iconic documentary film, The Corporation, that accompanied that book. He's out with a new book now, The New Corporation, How Good Corporations Are Bad for Democracy and True to Form. There's a documentary film that goes with it, The New Corporation, the unfortunately necessary sequel. Well, when we talk about the role of government Joel, back when your first film was released, Grover Norquist was ascendant politically in the United States, and he's famous for saying that he would like to see, within 25 years, a government not done away with, but shrunk to a size small enough to be drowned in a bathtub. Is that where we are right now? Has Grover's wish come true? Has the idea of the role of government in our life, I mean, who cares about democracy if your government doesn't do anything but collect taxes?
Right. Well, I think, you know, a couple things have to be said about that approach. The first thing is that nobody, Norquist, nobody in on the right, nobody among the libertarian community actually believes what they say when they say we shouldn't have the state and we shouldn't have government. If we're going to have a market system, then we need to have property rights. We need to have contract rights. And if we're going to have property rights, we need somebody who's going to protect that. We need somebody who's going to make corporations. Corporations don't exist in nature. Corporations are constructions. They're basically ways that the law allows a whole bunch of people to take a whole bunch of money and to do things without being responsible for the consequences. I mean, that, any corporate law scholar, including myself, I will tell you that is basically, you know, you can say it in fancier ways, but that's basically what a corporation does. Is it allows shareholders to make money from enterprise without suffering legal liabilities for what happens, because the corporate person, which is a fiction, assumes all the liability. The real people behind it get off scot-free. So, you know, we have this incredible intervention of the state and government on the side of capital, on the side of property, on the side of ensuring that a market system works. And then these same people say we don't need government. So what they're really saying is, we do need government to serve our interests, to serve the interests of capital and property, but we don't want government to be serving the interests of everybody else, i.e. the 99% of the people who need to be protected from us. So that, so it just needs to be said that that's what's happening. So,
well, that's the surplus population that you mentioned, right? The rest of us, I mean, Vijay Prajad at the Tricontinental Institute, he talks about something called platform capitalism that has arisen in the wake of the COVID-19. And this is where they do, as you suggest, they'll educate us remotely. They'll put us in little boxes at home to work atomistically. And they really don't need a huge number of us at all.
Well, they don't need a huge number of us. They just need us to do certain things that will create labor, create consumption, that can create wealth, that can then be funneled up to the top with governments and states providing that funnel. That's what they want. And so when you ask, have we ended up in that world where government has been shrunk? I think the answer is we've ended up in a world where government and state power have been put thoroughly behind the interests of capital, where social systems and social services have been taken away, have been rolled back, have been privatized, where public regulations have been rolled back, have been deregulated. And so we've ended up not with state power diminishing, but with state power shifting way in the direction of the interests of the very few who benefit within the corporate capitalist system, and being taken away from everybody else, all the people who do all the work and do all the consuming. So, you know, that's kind of what has happened over the last 40 years. And it's happened even more acutely over the last 20. And it's happened while corporations are at the same time saying, hey, we're out for you. You know, we care about you. We want to help you. We want to, you know, make sure that everybody's life is good. And so as the corporation is kind of upping the rhetoric of how good it is, the world is becoming much more unequal, much more polluted, climate is deteriorating, democracy is deteriorating. And so it's this incredible sort of weird ideological dissonance that we're in the middle of right now. But the material effects of it are quite literally devastating for people's lives, for the environment, and for democracy.
Well, the world is so different and so weird right now with the COVID situation. Now, your documentary is opening, though, and I understand theaters are starting to open here and there. I'm looking at the TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival website. They have your film opening at the West Island Open Air Cinema at Ontario Place and at the Bell Lightbox and online as well. Those showtimes are the 13th, 16th, and 16th, respectively. Do you want to describe how you're getting this film out there, given the situation?
I don't know. I mean, it's officially confirmed, I think, for Toronto and the Maritimes in terms of film festivals. I can say that I'm pretty certain, but can't say officially, that it will be in other Canadian film festivals in major Canadian cities. It'll be in U.S. film festivals. It'll be in other film festivals across the world. So the film festival piece seems the simplest piece, in that the film festivals are all happening. It's just that some of them are happening completely online, and others are, like Toronto, in a more hybrid format with all kinds of safety measures and all of that. After that, it's a real sort of interesting question that my producers of the film, Trish Dolman and Betsy Carson, that are sort of distributors, are struggling with. I mean, you know, there's always the possibility of selling the whole thing to a platform like Netflix. But that has certain drawbacks to it, in that when you do that, basically they have all of the rights globally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're not left with any sort of flexibility to try to do some kind of a theatrical release, depending on how the COVID thing goes. It's really a new and different world. We have this, I think I'm really proud of this film. I think it's an amazing film to watch. And I just really want it to get out. I think, you know, from the just filmmaking perspective, music and picture, the narrative, it's just a very compelling film. But it also tells a story and reveals things that I think we really need to be engaging with. Especially in the United States, coming up to their election in November. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I wish I could answer your question, but we all have the same question. And I guess the advantage of, you know, the world that we live in right now is that there are digital ways to get it out there. And, you know, so we're probably in the ironic situation of using the master's tools. And we're always in this situation. And anything we do, using the master's tools to maybe not take down, but seriously renovate the house.
Yeah. Well, I got a preview look at the film last night, and I'm a huge fan of the original, and this film is just as good. And the music you mentioned, Victoria Local, Velcro Ripper, also a filmmaker in his own right of the fantastic Metamorphosis film, did the music in this. Well, we're fast out of time here, Joel. Before we go, can you just give us your website so people can go there and get more information about screenings and how to do it online and so forth?
Yeah, the newcorporation.movie is the film. My personal website is just joelbakken.com.
B-A-K-A-N. Thanks a lot, Joel, again for coming on, eh?
Thank you, Chris. I've really enjoyed talking to you, and happy to come on anytime.
That I've met someone who could break me in half with a look, a whisper, a snap, or an unreturned text. I should bail, there's no question, this is gonna end badly. Since every instinct I've developed to keep, but fuck it, I'm staying, please pull me ashore when I wreck. Cause I can see a future I don't wanna live in, where I'm angry and sad. The point of living if that's where I go. See, the fascists are coming. forgotten.